This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. By the time my guest Seth Green became famous for his role in Austin Powers as Dr. Evil's son, Scott Evil, he was already a veteran. Green started making movies when he was 8 and landed a part in Hotel New Hampshire. When he was 12, he got a leading role as the boy in Woody Allen's film Radio Days. His other movies include Without a Paddle, The Italian Job, Party Monster, and Enemy of the State. On TV, he had a recurring role as Oz in Buffy the Vampire Slayer, starred in Greg the Bunny, and does the voice of the son Chris on the animated comedy series Family Guy. Now Green is doing lots of voices for a stop-motion animated series that he co-created. It's called Robot Chicken, and it debuted Sunday night on the Cartoon Network as part of the block called Adult Swim. Green describes the show as a fast-paced, stop-motion sketch variety show. Saturday Night Live meets The Nightmare Before Christmas.
You know, a stop-motion animation seems painstaking because basically you're moving, since you're photographing it, you're moving every figure, what, like a quarter of an inch or something, and then photographing it again?
Less than that. I mean, we photograph it frame by frame, and it's 32 frames per second. So depending on the speed of the movement, the animators adjust the puppets within that time ratio. Luckily, I don't have to do that. We have the top team of animators. We just have some of the best people in the business have come to work on the show, and that's what they love to do. Just like, you know, you're great at interviewing, and I like acting. These people are happiest when they're isolated in a booth with their music in their ears, adjusting puppets for, you know, 12 hours at a time.
One of the early parodies in Robot Chicken is a parody of the "This Is Your Brain on Drugs" commercial.
Yeah, we went round and round with the Partnership for a Drug-Free America to get consent to use Rachel Lee Cook in the voice because it's considered intellectual property. This is one of the things that we've learned a lot about producing the show is where using the actual person who did the original project, how you can parody that using them. We just had to go clear it legally with each one of these parent companies.
So the Partnership for a Drug-Free America gave you permission to use the actor who actually did the "This Is Your Brain on Drugs" commercial?
Yeah, Rachel Lee Cook, before she was in She's All That and all the movies that she's done since then, did this commercial, that "This Is Your Brain, This Is Your Brain on Drugs. You know, this is what happens when you snort heroin," that kind of thing. And we just amped it up. We have her running around the neighborhood, smashing up grandmas and microwaves and cats and cars and just flipping out because it's silly.
Let's talk a little bit about your acting career, your movie career.
It doesn't get any bigger, Terry. Seriously. I mean, I may not be winning awards, but, you know.
Well, you certainly started young enough. You were in Hotel New Hampshire at the age of 8, and then at the age of 12, you were in Radio Days, the Woody Allen movie.
It's all true.
And this is a film that's narrated by Woody Allen, and it's a flashback. So you play the young version of the character who's narrating. So it's as if you're the young Woody Allen.
Yeah. A distinction I've shared with many redheaded kids.
Well, why don't we play a short scene from the movie? This is from early in the film. You're in the living room. Your parents are listening to the radio. Your father's reading Life magazine. And your parents are played by Julie Kavner and Michael Tucker.
Hey, can I have 15 cents for the new Mass Avenger rate?
What am I made of money?
Pay more attention to your schoolwork and less to the radio.
You always listen to the radio.
It's different. Our lives are ruined already. You still have a chance to grow up and be somebody.
You think I want you working at the job I do?
I don't even know what your job is.
Gotta get an education.
While I'm getting it, can I get the secret compartment ring?
We don't have money to waste.
That's a scene from Radio Days. Seth Green, did you see yourself as playing the young Woody Allen?
You know, he's very, he's not very forthcoming with information when you're working. And plus, I was 12, so I didn't have a lot of character questions to ask him. I was more concerned with getting my schoolwork done, so I wasn't obligated to it, and figuring out what new G.I. Joe toys had come out. It was a blast. I had no idea that was the character until months and months later. Actually, Mia Farrow introduced me to somebody as playing young Woody in his new movie, and that was kind of when the first time I heard it.
What are some of the ways that Radio Days changed your life once it came out?
I got to do The Tonight Show, and I got to meet Johnny Carson and Angie Dickinson, and that was about the coolest thing in the world.
What was the story that you told on The Tonight Show? Everybody gets to tell a great story.
I don't even remember. I've seen, the last time I saw the tape was about 7 years ago, and I'm such a horrific fashion victim. It was the year that I let my sister dress me because I was sick of getting beat up in school. And she put me in, like, Cavarici jeans rolled up under the calf with socks and Reeboks and a Coca-Cola sweatshirt. I had, you know, a skater flop in the front with a mullet in the back. I was just tragic. And I came on telling Johnny Carson stories about Toy Fair and gave him some Ghostbusters ectoplasm. So I don't know how good an impression I made.
So did you get a lot of offers for other movies?
I guess I did. I don't know. I worked pretty consistently until I was about 15, and then I had a year of just nothing because I was kind of transitioning into older parts, and people were expecting this young kid who looked a specific way and who played a specific character, and I was suddenly doing... I just went through a rough time in my life. Like, my parents were getting divorced, and school was really awful, and the common things I think the kids go through when they're that age. And grew my hair out long, got really into Guns N' Roses, got my ear pierced, and all of a sudden started playing tougher kids, you know, and got into the concept of being a more character actor, like, as opposed to aiming for being Tom Cruise in Risky Business, being more like Joe Pantoliano in Risky Business.
What happened to the money that you made? Did you have any say in what was done with it?
Yeah, you know, there's great laws in effect because of the way that kids got taken advantage of in the careers before me. The Jackie Coogan law insists that kids' money be put into a trust fund with certain allowances made to keep you functioning. Like, you can receive a portion of it to pay your bills, but for the most part, you're set aside and guaranteed to have money when you turn 18.
So that
I didn't make
out.
A lot as a kid, though. I never made a lot as a kid. I was never an in-demand star. I didn't have a top-grossing movie, and I was never, you know, like you look at Macaulay Culkin, who at 10 years old was making $3 to $8 million, and we were just in very different positions. But I think that benefited me later in life because it gave me the ability to transition kind of seamlessly and without prejudice from a teen actor to an adult actor.
My guest is actor Seth Green, and he's co-created a new stop-motion animation series that's going to be on Adult Swim on the Cartoon Network, and it's called Robot Chicken. Let's talk about one of your really famous movies or series of movies, and I'm thinking of Austin Powers, in which you were the son of Dr. Evil. How did you get the part?
That was a total luck shot. I was working in San Diego on the first and only full-length play I've ever done, and couldn't leave to audition. And the word that I got was that they'd been all over town and kind of looked at a bunch of different people and hadn't quite found what they were looking for, and wanted to meet me. So I went and met with Jay Roach, and we just hit it off. And he liked what I did, and I got that job, which was great. And the funniest legend of this movie is that I got offered Carrot Top's chairman of the board on the same day that I got offered Mike Myers' Austin Powers. And it was a heavy debate for a second because they were both equally, they were just debatable projects. You know, Mike I knew from SNL and had some success with Wayne's World, but the last movie he'd done was So I Married an Axe Murderer, which was kind of a misunderstood conception. And Carrot Top was being poised to be the next big comedian in the script. They were both equally, you could just screw it up in a million different directions. It was completely subject to interpretation as to how these were going to be done. And the scripts were what's the word I'm looking for? They were just a tough sell. If you read Austin Powers on paper, you'd think it was funny, but until you see it executed, you don't know if it's going to work. And the same with Chairman of the Board. But lucky for me, I picked Austin Powers.
Yeah, you made the right choice, didn't you?
Well, you never know. It could have gone 100% the other way.
So what did Mike Myers tell you about the movie and about your role?
We talked more about the legitimate dynamics of these personalities, and that's what I think people reacted to, was the fact that in spite of the notion that this guy is this evil doctor, this mad scientist, this, you know, world-dominating dictator, that he has a very traditional and relatable, awkward relationship with his son. And we just played the reality of that. I think that's why I got that job, was because I really played it like a kid who was meeting his dad for the first time. And just, you ignore all the details and make those just part of the reality of the character, you know? We play it all straight. I think that's what's so funny.
So how did the popularity of Austin Powers affect your movie career?
Yeah, it was just a weird thing that happened because I've never really been part of anything that's financially successful. So the fact that that movie made money was weird, and I had people coming up to me about it. It gave me... I just had a lot of things happen at the same time. I did this movie called Can't Hardly Wait, which was real popular with kids, and Austin Powers came out on video, and I got cast as a series regular on Buffy, and all of a sudden, people knew my name. And that made a difference. It got me a higher quality of audition and gave people something to reference me from. You know, it gave me a parenthetical in Entertainment Weekly, so...
My guest is Seth Green. Let's hear a scene from the first Austin Powers film, Austin Powers: International Man of Mystery. Seth Green plays Scott Evil, the teenage son of Austin Powers' nemesis, Dr. Evil, played by Mike Myers. Scott Evil was made from Dr. Evil's genes while Dr. Evil was cryogenically frozen. In this scene, it's just after they've met for the first time. Dr. Evil and Scott are attending a father-son group therapy session. The therapist is played by Carrie Fisher.
Hello, Dr. Evil.
Hello, Scott.
Hello, everybody.
So, Scott, why don't we start with you? What brings you here with us today?
Well, I just really met my dad for the first time 5 days ago.
I was partially frozen his whole life.
That is beautiful that you can admit to that.
He comes back, and now he wants me to take over the family business.
But, Scott, who's going to take over the world when I die?
Listen to the words he used. Who's going to take over the world when I die? Feels like that to some of us sometimes, doesn't it? Yes. So, what do you want to do, Scott?
I don't know. I was thinking I like animals. Maybe I'd be a vet.
An evil vet?
No. Maybe like work in a petting zoo.
An evil petting zoo?
You always do that! What? I just think like he hates me. I really think he wants to kill me.
Now, Scott, we don't want to kill each other in here. We might say that we do sometimes, but we really don't.
Actually, the boy's quite astute. I really am trying to kill him, but so far unsuccessfully. He's quite wily like his old man.
This is what I'm talking about.
I want to talk about another movie that you made. It's called Party Monster, and yeah. Probably a lot fewer people saw this than saw Austin Powers, but it's really a wonderful film.
Thank you.
And you and Macaulay Culkin star in this. You both play club kids in New York. It's based on a real story about two people. You play James St. James, who was really into the scene, a real mover in the scene.
He was one of the Warhol celebutants that enjoyed a little bit of success in the revamping of the New York club scene. What happened was this kid, Michael Alig, who was just wouldn't take no for an answer in New York, reinvented himself as the next Warhol and just took the reins and took control of the whole thing and became a promoter and owned it and created a $1 million business in the city and pioneered the notion of, not pioneered it, but took it to the next level. Whereas Warhol said everyone will have their 15 minutes, Michael said we're going to create a legion of superstars that people will revere. And we will be at the top echelon of the clubs. The only thing that's separating us from the people who run the place is the drive to take it over. And that's what they did. They invented these elaborate characters and costumes for themselves and changed it every night. And they went on Jenny Jones and they went across the country. They went on Geraldo and recruited kids and invented this sensation. They really created a movement. But the whole thing imploded. You know, everyone became so consumed with their own ego and drugs, and it just had no, it had no rules, it had no boundaries, and people, you know, when you get in that situation, people just push it further and further until it implodes. And Michael became so crazed and drug sick that he murdered a friend of his, this drug dealer, Angel Melendez, and, you know, sickeningly murdered him and dismembered him and discarded him, and it's just a shocking, shocking story, and it's all true.
Your character is his mentor early in the movie. He comes to New York, and you're teaching him how to be fabulous. And in fact, let me play a scene in which you and Macaulay Culkin as Michael Alig are in a donut shop together, and you are literally giving him the rules of fabulous.
Now, it's all about photo placement. So if you're in a group of three, always, always, always make sure that you're the one standing on the right. Because that way, when they print the picture, you'll be the one on the left. And the caption will read, James St. James and blah, 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 we're seen, okay? Okay, rules of press. Number one, no publicity is bad publicity. Number two, once something is printed, it automatically becomes true. So number three, never, ever dish anyone in print. Never be seen drinking anything other than champagne, and never take heroin, never wear white after Labor Day, and avoid that one like the plague.
More, more.
That's Seth Green and Macaulay Culkin in a scene from Party Monster. Seth Green, was it hard to get into the sensibility of being fabulous? It's not the kind of character you'd played before.
No, there's two great factors in this. The one is that I got to audition for a movie about four, maybe 5 years prior called The Velocity of Gary, where I auditioned for a Patsy Cline obsessed drag queen. And I just wasn't ready for it. My take on that character, I didn't understand the concept of what makes people take on that lifestyle. So I played her as kind of a shy and demure sweetie pie girl, whereas she's meant to be, you know, a guy who feels completely uncomfortable in his own skin until he puts on all these details, and then he feels like himself. And that was at the core of it. And I kind of promised myself when I blew that audition that if I ever had the opportunity to do it again, that I'd really take it on. And Randy Barbato and Fenton Bailey came to me with this project, and they'd produced a documentary which had all the real footage of these kids. And James St. James had written a book called Disco Bloodbath, which was the true accounting from his perspective. And he's a brilliant writer. That book is really gripping. And I got both of those details, and then they said they wanted me to play James. And I just looked him straight in the eye and said, I'll do it. I didn't even want to ask what made him think that I could. I just said, I want it. I'll take it, and I will kill. I will rip this part apart and make it great. And I just kind of promised to give him everything I had. And they told me that they wanted Mac for it, and he and I had met just weeks prior at a Saturday Night Live party, of all things. And I've always just liked him. I've always been respectful and impressed by him because of the way he's handled himself in the eye of a hurricane. This is a young boy who took it upon himself to decide that he wanted to take a break from the mayhem that had been created around him and wanted to kind of reclaim ownership of his life. He's arguably the most famous person I've ever met. That's not true. I met Michael Jackson, but we don't get to hang out. So I get to watch Mac in circumstances, social circumstances. He's constantly approached. He's constantly touched and, you know, collected and corralled, and just people say the most insanely inappropriate things with him, and he is alarmingly appropriate. He just governs it. He just owns himself so well, and I'm really impressed by him. So we got to meet and have a chat, and then when Randy and Fenton said they wanted him to play the part, he was in LA, and we sat down and had like a whole talk about being kids and being kid actors and what it is to grow up in this business and what this movie is. We just really connected. And then over the next 2 years that it took them to finance it, we became good friends and both did a ton of research into these parts. Lucky for us, the club kids were very narcissistic and filmed themselves all the time. And plus we had, because Randy and Fenton are documentary filmmakers, they had hundreds of hours of footage of these guys, both on talk shows, both at parties, also, you know, them filming themselves in their private lives. And we just had hours and hours and hours to pour through that were specific to scenes that we were making. So it offered us a unique opportunity to really get in the mind of these guys.
So can you talk a little bit about finding the voice and the walk and the attitude for your character in Party Monster?
Well, like I said, I had all this great footage to study at James, both on and off the camera, when he was on television versus when he was in private. And he has such a specific detail to his voice. From doing all the drugs that he did, he was very nasally. And he wasn't traditionally effeminate. You see like a stereotypical cross-dresser, and they always have like a very swishy attitude. And James just wasn't like that. He's a classy dame. This is a guy who ran with Warhol, and it was kind of slumming for him to become second banana to Michael Alec, which was a constant source of their rivalry. So I just really paid attention to him. And I remember about 6 days into actually shooting the movie, Mac and I were watching videotapes. We had a whole process. We would shoot every day. We'd come home. We'd come back to his place and relax and probably have breakfast because we shot all nights. We shot till like 5 a.m, 6 a.m. We'd have some breakfast and play some backgammon, sit and talk about what we'd done and how it worked and what it meant. And then we'd pore over footage that was germane to what we were going to do the next day. And we were watching both of we were watching all the club kids on Geraldo. And all of a sudden I heard James laugh. And it was so specific. And in the same thing, Michael laughed. We just looked at each other and then we started practicing their laughs. And then it became infectious to where we would just be doing their laughs all the time. And that was such an easy hook in. It was a ramp up. Anytime we were on set, we could just fall into their laughter.
What kept us
in character.
What was James's laugh?
He just has this really kind of, you know, almost forced staccato laugh. It just kind of escapes him even though he doesn't want it to. And Michael had this really bold, that's what they were. So we just started practicing that.
You started off making movies with people who were much older than you were. You were a kid, they were adults. What was it like for you when you started making movies with people who were either of your generation or at least a lot closer to it?
It's a different level of satisfaction, but I also feel the same responsibility to participate with anybody else who hasn't had the same amount of experience. When I worked on Hotel New Hampshire, Jodie Foster was like 19 years old, Rob Lowe was 19, Nastassja Kinski I think was 21, and they had all had levels of success that were way bigger than anything I'd even comprehended, and yet paying attention to what their priorities were as far as maintaining family relationships and being kind to people that approached them or furthering your education, those were really good influences. But also on set with what is appropriate, the type of familial relationship you acquire and how that's not a replacement for your own family, and just work ethic and professionality. And I mean, I really learned a lot by good example. I had the fortune of working with great people at a young age who were kind enough to offer me advice, whether it was verbal advice or just by example.
What was it like for you when you were young to be judged at auditions? I mean, I think it's hard for any actor to lose a part. When you're a kid, you're sometimes particularly vulnerable. In fact, kids are likely to break out into tears when they're rejected or yelled at or criticized. And that can be incredibly embarrassing, particularly if you're trying to be professional. So what was it like to get rejected? And did you ever cry at and be really embarrassed by it?
I spent so much time getting beat up and crying in my private life. I mean, growing up, my scholastic career was not all that satisfying on a social level. So for me, just getting to act was a real thrill. And of course, if you get emotionally attached to something, you want it real bad and you don't get it, it hurts. But I never took it as a failure on my part. I kind of had an objectivity at a young age that I've really held on to, where if you believe in a director or if you believe in a project, you have to respect their vision of what it is. And if you don't fit that vision, you just don't fit. And there's a lot of times where no matter how good an actor you are, you're just not right for it. And I became very aware and zen about that what I was going to get, I was going to get, nobody else was, and what somebody else was going to get, I wasn't. And comparing our careers or being envious of anybody else's salary or success or opportunities, it just didn't benefit me. I do everything I can to chase parts that I think are important to chase after, and if I get them, I do. And if I don't, I don't. I wanted American Beauty real bad, and I wanted Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind real bad, and I fought hard. As hard as I could for both of them. I put my, went and met with Sam Mendes, wasn't right, put myself on tape, like orchestrated a whole tape to show him what I could do, wrote a letter, offered my, please see me again. And I just wasn't right. And when I saw Wes Bentley, I was like, oh, that's why. I'm just not that. There's no debating it. No matter how similar I take on the character, is that that's just not me. And that's what he wanted. And with Eternal Sunshine, I flew to New York on my own dime, put myself up to meet with Michelle Gondry and read with Mark Ruffalo, and was there for 2 hours workshopping it, and it came down between me and Elijah, and Elijah got it. And Elijah's great in the movie, and the movie is beautiful, and everything that I, when reading it, would have ever hoped it could be, even though I can't claim any kind of participation. It's something that I can appreciate from the outside, and that's satisfying in a different way.
Did you develop this Zen attitude on your own, or did somebody encourage you to adapt it?
I think it just came with repeated failure. And the fact that I'm I'm aiming for longevity in the business. I want to do this for the rest of my life, and I don't think you can if you're sitting around cursing other people who get things that you wanted.
Did you
or cursing directors for not picking you.
Did you go to high school? Did you go to college?
Yeah, well, I went to high school. I graduated with honors from a public school in Philadelphia. I didn't go to college. I had terrible entry scores. And at the time when I would have been going to college, I had an on-air series for, I think it was ABC. And just had different priorities. Watched all my friends going to college and taking 2 years of requirements before they could even attempt their major. And I just thought that wasn't for me. I went to a used bookstore and bought a bunch of literature and philosophy and religion and just started doing my own studies.
What'd you read?
I read a lot. I read everything from Freud to Jung and studied up on religions from, you know, Buddhism to Christianity. Just kind of paid attention to what was going on and what all the similarities between each of those philosophies.
Did you have
what? Maybe that's when I got Zen.
So back when you were in high school, did it make you more cool to have been in movies and
I was never cool in high school.
No. Even being in movies?
It only set me apart because if I was gregarious and outgoing, then I was considered egotistical because I was an actor. And if I was withdrawn and kept to myself, then I was considered stuck up because I was an actor. There was really no winning for me. Plus, I was short and had red hair and a funny name and a big personality and an educated vocabulary and real points of opinion. And I'd get into debates with teachers, and I just was not well liked in school. But I got to a point in high school where I just decided, screw this. I'm gonna. I had attempted to get a conformist's makeover and wore all the things that everybody else wore and tried to do the things that everybody else did. It just didn't fit and nobody bought it. And they can smell a faker a mile away, you know, and I was a faker. So I just kind of got to the point where I decided that I was going to do what made sense for me and wear what made me feel comfortable. And part of that was, you know, shock and being outrageous and wearing an overcoat and growing my hair long and putting it in braids and getting them to stick out to the side just to kind of force people to deal with the fact that I was a weirdo, you know? But I concentrated on school and I concentrated on getting the hell out of there and aiming towards something that was more important to me.
So I take it that dating wasn't very good in high school?
I actually had a pretty good social life because I was involved with a youth group that was associated with my synagogue and the summer camp. And I was allowed the opportunity to reinvent myself without prejudice where, you know, at summer camp, I was good at sports instead of being last picked for kickball, you know?
Wait, so a synagogue youth group helped you reinvent yourself?
Going to summer camp helped me reinvent myself because I had a month away with people who didn't know me.
Right.
And I was allowed the opportunity to grow and develop skills, whether they were sports or art or, you know, I don't know, being good in color war. I got to meet people and I got to have a little bit of a social life. And then I had a youth group that was less religious than just field trippy. Like we went to the Rocky Horror Picture Show and you got a bunch of people, like 35, you know.
All the religious groups went to that. All the churches.
Yeah, well, it's just similarly aged kids getting to do things that were socially relevant for you know, growth and development.
So when you were in camp, you know, a lot of camps have musicals during what's called Color War, where you have to do pageants or shows with songs. And did you participate in that?
I did. I started at that camp when I was too young to be a camper because my mom ran the art program for a couple of years. And eventually I became a camper. But when I was really young and just a staff brat, I got to be Woodstock in You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown. And I also had one line in Hello, Dolly. And that was that was really when I thought I can do this. You know, I just enjoyed it. It felt really natural. I was like 5 or 6 years old and I just liked it. It just made sense. It was something that I'd always done, dressing up and performing, you know.
Well, I want to wish you good luck with the new series.
Thanks very much. Well, this has been a lot of fun.
Seth Green co-created and does voices for the new series Robot Chicken on the Cartoon Network. It debuted Sunday.